Good evening, everybody. Tonight's communique, just in from Invasion Headquarters, summarizes the news of all the successful landings. Allied forces, it says, have succeeded in their initial landings in France, and fighting continues. The communique goes on with air action, saying that all day Allied planes continued their bombing in what the dispatch calls very great strength. Another bulletin states that a German counterattack is in the making. It says the first German counterattack is likely to materialize within the next 48 hours. And another bulletin just in emphasizes the element of surprise, saying that the Nazis were caught off their guard in an effective surprise by the Allied forces. Well, the news pictures Allied troops battling in the streets of the Norman city of Caen. That place is 9.5 miles inland, which represents a drive of that far from the beachheads established early this morning. The Germans tell us that the landing forces are broadening and strengthening their positions and getting incessant reinforcements. New masses of troops, new tons of armament pouring ashore. Caen is at the base of the Norman Peninsula, which thrusts northward into the English Channel, and the drive to the town makes it look as if the strategy were to cut across the base of that peninsula and force a Nazi withdrawal from the whole area. The possession of that peninsula would mean a powerful base from which Allied thrusts could be driven inland, probably in the direction of Paris. To the British troops in the Second Front forces, that town of Caen represents historic memories. That is, if they have time to think about it. For it was there in the river that William the Conqueror in 1066 assembled his fleet with which he invaded Britain, the Norman Conquest. And the mortal remains of the Conqueror lie interred in the church of Saint-Étienne in the city of Caen. The latest advices from both sides, Allied and enemy, picture the invasion as concentrated at three points: the mouth of the Orne River, where Caen lies, and 40 miles westward along the coast, the mouth of the Vire River. That point, too, threatens the base of the peninsula, and the Germans report that the Allied troops have cut an important highway still further along. Nazi accounts tell us that there have been landings also in the area between Boulogne and Calais. The Dover Straits, across the narrowest width of water from Britain. The German radio is quoted as saying that Allied airborne troops have seized a flying field in that sector, although there is no Allied confirmation of this so far. It so happens that the coastal battlefield is one of the most familiar stretches of ground on this earth. The French Channel shore from Cherbourg to Le Havre, for many years one of the commonest routes of travel for American tourists visiting Europe. They often landed at Cherbourg, and then the railroad to Paris took them along the coastal lands. I myself have made that railroad trip many a time and have seen the coast from the waterside. Flat country, only slight rises of ground from the beaches. Cherbourg itself on a tall, rugged headland, a strongly fortified harbor just below. And around Calais and Dieppe, there are cliffs, like those white cliffs of Dover right across the channel. But in between the Calais-Dieppe area and Cherbourg, the beaches are broad and flat, and the level ground extends on inward, a water-level route to Paris. And so, any of the thousands of travelers who have made the railroad trip will appreciate the statement in the invasion news coming in that the most favorable stretch of coast was selected for the second front landings today. The events of today were studded with records, too. The greatest fleet of ships ever to set sail. 4,000 ships and thousands of lesser craft. The greatest army ever to strike at a hostile shore. That vast force of men and machines, tens of thousands of men increasing to hundreds of thousands, millions before it is over. And the greatest air assault ever delivered. Before the day began in the hours of darkness between midnight and dawn, thousands of British planes hurled more than 5,000 tons of bombs on the Nazi fortifications. Then more than 1,000 American heavy bombers took up the assault, and soon the total tonnage of bombs was more than 11,000. A British air officer remarks that the total tonnage of bombs dropped in this one day of invasion was greater than the amount that the Germans hurled on Britain during the entire 6 months of the Great Blitz. The most colorful news of the day concerns the paratroopers, those airborne forces which struck behind the Nazi Atlantic walls in advance of the landing of the seaborne soldiers. A United Press correspondent who witnessed invasion scenes from the coast of England describes the sky as looking like what he calls a Christmas tree with colored lights strung out in long lines. These, he goes on, were the running lights of the planes carrying airborne troops. The lights were to identify them to anti-aircraft batteries in Britain Wave after wave of these airborne fleets, he relates, passed over the coast in a steady stream, their colored lights beaming and finally vanishing as they disappeared over the channel in the direction of France. In that first wave of paratroopers was an outfit which reminds you of American history of times gone by. Indians, yes, Indians, wearing their tribal scalp locks. They restrained their tribal war whoop, however, while descending silently, parachuting to earth. Then all of their ancestral stealth was needed when they got down, as they spread out over the country today. Their job needed the stealth of the braves of times gone by. For these Indians, landing in France today, were Yaqui and Cherokee tribesmen. They were demolition engineers whose task it was to sneak in and blow up enemy installations. One of the paratroopers to jump today was Robert Hillman of Hartford, Connecticut, who felt an especial sense of security. This story, by the way, is wired me by an old friend, Ted Chain of the Black Watch, author of a book called Heroes of the Pacific. Chain tells how recently Private Hillman said to a colonel at inspection, "I know my chute is okay because my mother checked it. She works in the Pioneer Parachute Company in our town, and her job is giving the final once over to all the chutes." Prime Minister Winston Churchill's formal report on D-Day was given in tones of measured optimism in two statements to the House of Commons, the second of which recited the progress of events up to mid-afternoon. Sober and factual tones made his disclosures all the more encouraging. "This operation," said Winston Churchill to the Commons, "is proceeding in a highly satisfactory manner." And then he went on, "Many dangers and difficulties which last night seemed to be extremely formidable are behind us. Passage of the sea," he exclaimed, "has been made with far less loss than we apprehended." And he went on to say that the bristling batteries of Nazi guns across the channel had been greatly weakened by air bombing and the fire of naval artillery. And Churchill emphasized in these words, "Landings and follow-ups are proceeding with very much less loss than we expected." However, Churchill went on with his usual note of realistic caution. "All this," he said, "although a very favorable and vitally essential first step, cannot indicate what may be the course of battle in the next few weeks, because the enemy will endeavor to concentrate in this area. And in that event, heavy fighting," said Churchill, "will soon begin and will continue without any end so long as the enemy can push troops in. This is, however," he concluded, "the most serious time, and we enter upon it with our great allies, all in good heart and good friendship." President Roosevelt this afternoon added his own warning against overconfidence. He pointed out that it is one thing to land successfully on enemy beaches and another to drive the long, hard miles to the heart of the enemy country. The president said that the decision to launch today's blow was made last December at the Churchill-Stalin-Roosevelt Conference in Tehran. It was then decided that the second front would get underway toward the end of May or the first days of June. No exact date could be fixed because that depended on accidents of weather. The president added that he himself had known the exact date, Tuesday, June 6, 1944, only during these past few days. So he knew it last night when he was on the radio. The president says that while he was on the air making his broadcast concerning the fall of Rome, he was aware that the invasion boats already were on their way across the English Channel. One of the tense turns of drama was enacted today in a motor trailer under a tent somewhere along the southern coast of England. The trailer, headquarters of General Ike Eisenhower. From this, he will direct the onslaught until the Allied command crosses the channel and sets up headquarters on French soil. So early this morning, there was the ruddy face and ordinarily smiling Eisenhower. But he was tense now, in a moment of his great decision. It was for him to give the order for the hurling of the second front. Was this the time? Should he set the whole vast offensive into operation? That was a question of weather. It had been noticed that during the past 48 hours, the usual Eisenhower posture had been head cocked up, looking at the sky. D-Day had been scheduled for yesterday, but no, it did not take one of those Eisenhower looks at the sky to see that the weather was bad, stormy, bad for flying, impossible for paratroop operations, channel too rough for the efficient handling of boats. The general's glances upward were a quest for signs of clearing, harbingers of better weather. So what were the prospects for today? Eisenhower and the top-ranking commanders studied the weather report, the weatherman being the real commander-in-chief for the declaration of D-Day. The meteorological reports turned out to be good enough, but the weather today was by no means perfect. Not too good for bombing fleets of the sky, though these did a huge and devastating task. The channel was quieter than yesterday, though still choppy. That turbulent strait, whose seasickness-producing antics are a legend. For the airborne assault, the question of weather was the most critical of all. Things have got to be just right for dropping paratroopers in the dim break between darkness and dawn. Well, all of these chances were a weighty burden on the mind of the commanding general, who had to decide, go ahead or delay again. Eisenhower has ample heart and courage for making a decision, and he gave the fateful order, D-Day. Surely he had enough to occupy the mind of any one man, enough to monopolize every thought in his head. And yet I wonder whether his fancy did not stray, at least for a brief moment, to this side of the ocean. I wonder, did he stop and think for a moment of that tall bluff on the broad river, with the height crowned by stately buildings? Did he think of West Point and his wife and his son? For it's a moody coincidence that this invasion day, which Eisenhower marked down in history, was also graduation day at West Point, and his son John was one of the graduating class. His mother was there to see him get his diploma, while his father was over there, commanding on D-Day. In Soviet Russia, the invasion news was announced with all the military fanfare that attends the proclamation of a great Red Army victory. And today's Moscow dispatch tells us that the Russian people exploded with an outburst of joy greater than they usually accord their own triumph. Everywhere in Moscow, the hope was expressed that the war would end quickly now, and the Red Army seems about to do its own large bit toward that happy consummation. The word is tonight that the Russians will launch another big offensive of their own within 24 or 48 hours, almost certainly before the end of this week. The second front to be supported by a new big push on the first front.